I'm your host, Phil Huff, and we were without a theme song this morning. I think the guy that normally sings that didn't show up today. But we do have a fabulous hour coming up. We're going to be talking with Liam Fitzgerald about his new book about avalanche forecasting, and Jeff Thompson from the Idaho Panhandle Avalanche Center. We'll get to that in a moment. Pressing on everyone's mind, if you got the Nixel alert, is the condition of the roads outside, which were icy. So do show caution driving. Stay home if you can. Come in if you have to, but be careful on the roads. Looking ahead today at the weather forecast, it's going to be partly sunny with a high of 41 degrees. A little bit more of that melt before it freezes again tonight, a low of 26. Tomorrow, it's looking like a chance of snow during the day, about 30%. Again, with a high in the 40s, lows in the 20s. That theme is going to repeat itself all week, so we're going to go through this freeze-thaw-freeze cycle. A bit of patchy fog Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and then who knows by Saturday what it's all going to lead to. And that is the weather. Highly unpredictable. We're going to be talking about predicting avalanches, which is even less predictable. Again, with us in the studio, Liam Fitzgerald, and I'll give you a little bit more of an introduction in a moment. Liam, say hello.
Morning.
Excellent. Thank you. Liam is the author of Throwing Stones in a Glass House, A Career Battling Avalanches in Little Cottonwood Canyon. We also have Jeff Thompson, who's a forecaster with the Idaho Panhandle Avalanche Center in the studio. Jeff, good morning.
Good morning, Phil.
Well, let's get into forecasting a little bit. I know you've been up and on the job, Jeff, since the wee hours this morning. How did that rain impact the snow pack last night, and what does that portend for avalanches today?
Well, great question, Phil, and I think you nailed it. The rain really had an effect on the lower elevation. Not only does it kind of weaken the snow surface and make it more susceptible to avalanches, but it also adds a lot of weight to some of the buried weak layers that we see, you know, lower in the snowpack. So right now we have, at higher elevations, we have all the new snow that we've just had, you know, would have created wind slabs and new snow problems. But as you move lower, let's say below 4,000 feet into that, you know, 2,000 to 3,000 foot range, you know, it's sort of a different problem. And with the sun coming out, you know, mid-March, higher in the sky, we're also seeing aspect-driven problems. You know, south faces, we have rain crusts or sun crusts and some faceted layers. And on the north side, we're still seeing a cold, insulated snowpack.
It's very complex, and the rain adds to that complexity.
Yeah, it really does.
We're going to come back to the topic of the local conditions and forecasting avalanches locally and the threats that they present. But we want to talk with Liam about his book, and it was a fabulous read, Liam. I really, truly enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Want to hear a whole lot more about it. For our listeners, though, who aren't familiar with you or the book yet, tell us a little bit about your background. Give us an overview about your career, how you got started with avalanche forecasting.
Well, my avalanche career began in November of 1968, when at the age of 22, I landed a job on the Squaw Valley Ski Patrol. As many of the listeners may know, Squaw Valley changed its name in 2021 and is now known as Palisades Tahoe. I spent 3 years on the patrol there and then migrated to Utah in the summer of 1971 after being offered a job working on the construction of the tram and chairlifts for the soon-to-be-opened Snowbird Ski Area in Little Cottonwood Canyon. And while I was working there that summer, I convinced the guy who had been hired as the ski patrol director to give me a job once winter arrived. Snowbird opened in December of 1971, and on opening day, a skier was caught and buried for over an hour. Miraculously, we found him, and he was alive and uninjured. But unfortunately, about a week later, there was another inbounds avalanche involving two other skiers. The rough start to Snowbird's opening that we had prompted management to make the decision that someone needed to devote all their time just to the avalanche program. And so about 6 weeks into the opening season, I was given the job of snow safety director, a position that at the time I probably really was not qualified to take on. Nonetheless, in spite of all that, I managed to survive and remained there for 27 years before I took a job with the Utah Department of Transportation managing the Highway Avalanche Safety Program in Little Cottonwood Canyon.
Canyon Road in Little Cottonwood Canyon is considered one of the more avalanche-prone roadways in North America, and quite a job to manage it. It did wear me down a bit, but I managed to remain there for about 16 years before I retired in 2014.
I think that was truly one of the center focuses of the book that made it so fascinating. You have the book with you. Why don't you give us a reading from the prologue about Little Cottonwood Canyon, your time there, to help the folks who are listening understand the context a little better.
Sure. Prologue. Epiphany. Deciding to lower the curtain on a lifelong career is a seminal moment in a person's life. It can mean an end to many things. A cherished personal identity, a deeply embedded daily routine, or a love affair with a comfortably familiar lifestyle. It can also mark the beginning of the transition to a more normal life that sooner or later faces all those who are lucky enough to have unique and interesting jobs. For me, that seminal moment came during an intense snowstorm on the night of February 23rd, 2013. My job at the time was that of supervisor and lead avalanche forecaster for the Utah Department of Transportation Highway Avalanche Safety Program in Little Cottonwood Canyon. I had held that position for the past 15 years, and during that time, it had gotten most all of my attention during my waking hours. That night, as I sat in the parking lot of the White Pine Trailhead, the headlights of my truck illuminating the foggy curtain of fat snowflakes that were still falling after hours of accumulation, watching the excruciatingly slow progress of perhaps 3,000 vehicles trying to negotiate the steep, snow-covered, two-lane road in order to get down and out of the canyon, I realized that I didn't want to do this anymore. What made watching this exodus so painful was the fact that I considered the safety of every person participating in the bumper-to-bumper parade of cars, trucks, and SUVs my responsibility, and that there were very few options available in order to maintain control over a situation I had allowed to develop and that I felt was becoming increasingly dangerous by the minute.
So here you are, after reading the opening and a bit more, you have what probably is every ski bum's dream job. You get paid to stay and play in the snow, and yet pretty quickly turns into a nightmare of sorts. You've got deaths and avalanche dangers to worry about, and move yourself to what's arguably one of the most complex places in the country here, Little Cottonwood Canyon. Tell us a little bit more about that topography, just how prone to avalanche it is.
Well, Little Cottonwood Canyon is defined by its steep glaciated terrain and abundant snowfall. And it is the birthplace of avalanche forecasting and control in North America. The canyon is home to two major ski resorts renowned for their extensive avalanche problems, a world-class heli-ski operation, and an abundance of very desirable and to a large degree very accessible backcountry skiing. There's a steep, dead-end, avalanche-prone highway that transports thousands of skiers and boarders to the upper reaches of the canyon every day during the winter. The average snowfall, dating back to 1946, measured annually from November 1st to April 30th, is 500 inches. And by the way, so far this winter, Alta has recorded over 600 inches. The average daily traffic volume on the canyon road during the height of the ski season is over 7,000 vehicles. And they all must pass under 35 major avalanche paths on the way to the resorts at the beginning of the day, and once again when headed down canyon at the end of the day. Of the 170 buildings in the upper canyon, at least 54 of them are threatened by avalanches during the winter season. And all of this is located within a 90-minute drive for roughly 1 million people.
It sounds very stressful. And if you make a decision to close the road or the resort travel, that has some real life implications on individuals and businesses. Tell us about the stress of having to make that decision, yes or no.
Well, the highway is the lifeline for the two ski resorts, Alta and Snowbird, as well as several businesses located in the Upper Canyon. And when the road is closed for avalanche concerns, there is a significant loss of revenue. the people who are up there, the homeowners and the lodge guests, who are oftentimes restricted to the buildings that they're in for 24 hours or more at times, may wonder why they can't go outside and enjoy the snow that they see piling up around the outside of their windows. But we implement something called interlodge travel restrictions during high periods of high avalanche hazard, which means everyone has to stay inside during that period. Most of the people who come up to go skiing or boarding every day have little understanding of how dangerous conditions can become and how quickly things can change from fun to dangerous. And they all want to have a great day of skiing and expect to get home safely at the end of the day.
So how did you last 40 years without having a heart attack?
Well, in spite of the fact that I am by nature a worrier, I guess I must have had a few other attributes that kept me from losing my mind. But perhaps more importantly, I had good mentors, as well as other people who I looked up to that influenced how I did the job. As far as remaining alive in a hazardous profession, I'm not quite sure. I know that it's important to be honest with yourself as to just why you might consider doing something that could be considered risky or dangerous, and to truly understand the reasons why you're willing to take those risks, and to ask yourself, is it really worth it? I learned early on in my career that in dealing with avalanche concerns, especially when the lives of other people are at stake, it's best to take the more conservative route. Mm-hmm. But like most all other avalanche workers, I sort of have I'm willing to accept a higher level of risk for myself than I am for the general public.
Yeah, and you mentioned some conditions there in the backcountry that you ski through in a couple of slides you were caught up in. If you didn't die of a heart attack, it's amazing you didn't die of one of those avalanches.
Well, those avalanches took place within the boundaries of the ski resort, and
so workman's comp would cover your death.
Yeah, and avalanche workers throughout the world encounter the same type of risk daily. They're putting themselves in harm's way so that other people can travel, work, or recreate and have a safe experience.
I want to bring Jeff into this part of the conversation in addition to talking at the end. Speaking of mentors, Jeff, tell us how you met Liam.
Well, I think I met Liam before he met me. When I was a young ski patroller in the early 90s, or mid-90s, I should say, a college roommate of mine, Damian Jackson, moved to Alta. He had patrolled in Colorado with me and moved to Alta. And so when I had free moments, I would shoot the 7 hours out there to Little Cottonwood Canyon, and I would stay in a place called The Mine. He had a little mattress in a back room, and we got woken up by the chairlift turning, and we could look down the hill and we could see lights on in the room and see Liam up, you know, all hours of the morning, looking at the snow and looking at the weather and making decisions. And you know, Liam's been a big part of the avalanche world for a long time, not just nationally, but worldwide. And, you know, I've always admired the work that Liam has done. And so in those early years, you know, I really looked up to Liam and Alta and Snowbird and the people in that canyon. You know, just like Liam said, I mean, they really were the founders of the way we manage avalanche problems and forecast these days. And so it was neat to start my career you know, kind of idolizing Liam, and then, you know, eventually my career led me to North Idaho, where we've crossed paths over the last couple of years, and it's been great to get to know Liam on a different level, and he's been a big part helping us with the Avalanche Center and teaching classes and coming up to Schweitzer. So it's kind of been a neat journey getting to know Liam.
And you saw all of the stress and the burning of the midnight oil and the high risk personally, and thought, I'm in.
Absolutely. And you know, if you had told me all of that from the start, you know, I might have to think it through a little bit more than I did. I was probably thinking more about the powder and the steep lines that were at those ski areas. But it does lead me into a question I have for Liam, because, you know, I know that Liam has had to manage this level of stress and mental health for years, because being in the industry, and this is such a hot topic right now in the avalanche world, you know, Liam mentioned not having control of the snow. It's Mother Nature, and Mother Nature has a mind of her own. And, you know, we do have limited resources, especially up here in North Idaho. You know, there are resources in Little Cottonwood Canyon. But Liam, I was hoping that you could just personally, you know, talk about your personal challenges with that, and maybe some pointers for the ski patrollers and the avalanche workers that are out there, you know, as this is such a hot topic, and things that you've done to help manage your personal situation with that.
Well, I believe that it's really important to have people close to you in your team or your organization that you can talk to, that you can confide in, that you trust, because you are bound to make mistakes. And if you have other people sort of, you know, that you once again trust and believe in, if they're standing over your shoulder watching you, helping you make these decisions, you're less likely probably to do something catastrophically wrong. There are moments of, you know, frustration and disappointment and sorrow and exasperation. And, you know, if you physically get worn down, and it's important to realize that, you know, we're all humans. We all suffer from the same, you know, inadequacies and deficiencies, and that sooner or later we're going to wear ourselves down. So being able to acknowledge the fact that we are human and need to have emotional and physical breaks every now and then is something important to our well-being. And it's important to reach out to the people with whom you work also, and to always be aware of situationally of how they're feeling about what's going on as well, because it's definitely not a solo sport. It's a team effort, and the team needs to be there supporting each one another in everything that's done.
You obviously put a tremendous amount of passion into your work, and it comes through in the book. Tell us a little more about what motivated you to sit down and write a book about it.
Well, I think first of all, that when I was writing the book, I imagined that most of the people that might be reading it were either my family, close friends, people with whom I worked, or those who were familiar with what was going on in the time and place I was writing about, and that most of them would already know what was happening within my personal life anyway. For other readers who weren't a part of the story or who may not have been or had any direct association with the environment I was writing about, I guess I thought that most of them struggled with the same things that I struggled with, and that my personal life was one that they would probably be able to relate to.
Yeah, you're very courageous in discussing your personal life, and in a way, I think that is helpful for other people to gain an understanding. As you said, we're all imperfect, but it's a courageous person who bears their soul in a book like that for the world to read. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. Well. Yeah.
Are there any anecdotes from the book you'd like to share, or maybe some anecdotes that didn't make it into the book that you'd like to share?
Well, I anticipated this to some degree. There were obviously in, you know, a career like Jeff's or mine or you know, a myriad of other people, there's all sorts of stories that happen that, you know, some are fit for publication, others are not. One event that I thought might be worthy of telling is back in the early 80s when we were first becoming quite enamored with air blasts, which are explosive charges detonated above the snow surface that tend to affect a wider area than shots that go off on or below the surface. We were doing some helicopter bombing, and I came up with the great idea of putting 4 pounds of explosives on several 4 pound explosive charges on a number of bamboo poles, attaching a rope to the end of them, and then lowering them from the helicopter that would hover just above the snow surface, and the bamboo would be dropped and stick in the surface of the snow, and then we would fly away. This was going reasonably well, and then the last of the bamboo air blast that I was lowering, the rope caught on the skid of the helicopter when I dropped it. And so we left the Avalanche starting zone with 4 pounds of explosives tied to the bottom of the helicopter and starting to fly away. I looked down and saw this, and as the door was off to the helicopter, and had an immediate panic attack and said to the pilot that I thought we might have a bit of a problem. And he was pretty cool, calm, and collected, former Vietnam helicopter pilot. And he said, "What's the deal? Tell me." And I explained the situation, and he started to rock the helicopter back and forth enough that the rope untangled from the skid fell down onto the snow surface and detonated, which allowed us to continue on with our day.
Another close call. I think one of the things that fascinated me, not being in this world but on its periphery, is the use of military artillery to fire some of the detonations into the hillside, and probably a lot of people are familiar with that. And you note in the book that this is the only time outside of a war zone that the live fires would actually go over inhabited areas. And that just had to lead to an increased amount of stress.
Definitely, yes. And that takes place in Little Cottonwood Canyon. The Army, who provides the weapons for the avalanche programs throughout the Western U.S., they really don't like that situation. And because of that, it encouraged Utah Department of Transportation to install other avalanche control devices that are known as remote racks or remote avalanche control devices that are constructed in the starting zone and either deploy explosive charges or a mixture of oxygen and propane from the location. So that eliminates the necessity to fire certain targets with the round traveling over inhabited buildings. That is not the case for all the targets that are must be fired in Little Cottonwood Canyon, but it certainly over the last 5 or 6 years has reduced the number considerably. But it still is the practice that takes place.
Now, just to put listeners at ease, Jeff, there's no similarity up at Schweitzer. You're not firing howitzers across the White Pine Lodge, are you?
Correct. Nope.
Okay, no. None of that.
Just the hand charges.
Okay. Liam, everyone likes to know, one of the questions we usually ask, and usually fairly early on in the interview, is how you came to be in North Idaho. And your book tells a story about that. At least a few things fuzzy, but and that's probably purposefully so. Our listeners who haven't read the book, tell us how you came to find your home here in North Idaho.
Well, I first came to North Idaho in the summer of 1970 when I was hired to work on a BLM survey crew. We were bivouacked in Garfield Bay for the summer. While I was there, I met a wonderful local gal, and we were married a year or so later. And although our marriage didn't last, I still remained very close to our family and worked for them for a number of years, and ended up building a house near the where I had a small rustic cabin for 20 or so summers, and moved into it in November of 2014 after I retired with my wife and daughter.
Mm-hmm. So you did almost the reverse of what our local, pardon me, ski bums do. You came here during the summer and then went somewhere else in the winter.
Right. I had a job in the winter for, 46 or 47 years that kept me quite busy, but I had it arranged so that I could come up here in the summer and work. And remarkably enough, the job I had in the winter continued to pay me well to stay away during the summer months.
Well, it's nice to be able to play in the mountains year round, and then of course for retirement, it must have been no question. You just simply return, stay here.
Yep, retirement's great. Every night is like Friday night.
Except I know you've been involved somewhat with IPAC, so tell me how you've stayed fingers in a little bit of the industry, if you will, since you've been here.
Well, I believe it was pretty firmly established in my psyche that I needed to have some connection with the snow and avalanche world, and I've managed to continue to do that. I've had a couple of jobs since I've retired with other ski areas. more or less auditing their avalanche programs and providing some training assistance. As Jeff said, I was fortunate enough to be able to work with the Schweitzer Patrol for a couple of years, helping them with training, et cetera. And also I was involved with the avalanche center locally, and that was a great experience. I must say, though, most of the contact I have with snow lately comes in the form of removing it from my deck and driveways.
That's a whole lot better. Author of Liam Fitzgerald, author of Throwing Stones in a Glass House, A Career Battling Avalanches in Little Cottonwood Canyon. Maybe some of the listeners are so inclined to find a copy of the book right now. How can they do that?
There are copies available at the Corner Bookstore, at Vanderford's, and at Outdoor Experience. Mm-hmm. And the book can also be obtained online through booklocker.com or Amazon or Barnes & Noble.
Yeah. Shop locally. Support our local businesses.
Yes, definitely.
Do you have plans for another book, a sequel or a follow-up, something else?
Not at this time, but I did enjoy the first writing experience, so possibly.
Very good. We're going to take a short music break, then come back and Liam, hang around. We're going to talk with Jeff about local avalanche forecasting and how it's similar and not so similar to what we read in the book. The Blues Traveler, and the mountains win again, as they always seem to. We're back on the Tuesday Morning Show. This is KRFY 88.5 FM. I'm your morning show host, Phil Huff, and we're with Liam Fitzgerald, who has just finished writing a book about his career forecasting avalanches in Little Cottonwood Canyon. If you heard the first part of the show and missed any of it or want to listen to it again, as always, we'll have it available as a podcast on KRFY.org. We're also joined in the studio today with Jeff Thompson, a forecaster with the Idaho Panhandle Avalanche Center. Jeff, you've been on the show before, but we always have new listeners. Tell us a little bit more about yourself and your background and how you came to be doing what you're doing.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I kind of took a roundabout path. I grew up in North Delaware, which is just south of Philadelphia, so kind of a city kid. I fell in love with skiing before I ever went skiing. There's something about it. I don't know if I watched a show or, but I fell in love with it at a young age. And first time I went skiing was in a little ski area just outside of Philadelphia called Chad's Peak. I think it had maybe 100 vertical, not enough snow to connect the two ski runs, and you had to walk through the mud to get from one to the other. I don't think it's there anymore. A bunch of condos are there now, but I loved it. I really did. And I started working in the Poconos at a small ski area and decided that, you know, I needed, you know, my dad said, oh, you gotta make some money so you can go skiing. And that wasn't good enough for me. I needed to work in the ski industry. So I went out to Colorado and went to Colorado Mountain College and majored in ski area operations. And I didn't really know what I wanted to do with ski area operations, but I knew I wanted to ski and I knew I wanted to be a part of it. And I ended up taking two avalanche courses in the early, I guess it was in 95 and 96, as part of my college, because I was told that the avalanche courses are easy electives. They're easy A's. So I signed up for Avalanche 1. Pat Chant and Stu Schaefer, some old avalanche gurus from Central Colorado, were the instructors. Learned a ton from them. And then I ended up taking level 2. And at the time, level 2 was a full semester course. And I learned so much from it. And that's really where I cut my teeth in the avalanche world. I went on to work as a ski patroller at Beaver Creek and became a supervisor there. I was there for 20 years, managed the snow safety program for the last 10 years I was there. And after 20 years in Colorado, I decided I wanted a change of scenery. I loved Colorado, but I wanted to check out something different. And the opportunity presented itself up here in North Idaho. I had never really heard of Sandpoint or Schweitzer. And a friend of mine, Tom Eddy, who works on Schweitzer Ski Patrol, I met him in Canada up at Banff at a training. And he said, you got to come check it out. So I did. And one thing led to another and came up here to be the director of the Avalanche Center for I think 5 or 6 years and have kind of progressed my job into being just the lead forecaster for the Selkirk and Cabinet zone up here. And I still ski patrol up at Schweitzer. I work with avalanche rescue dogs, and I know the importance of a good avalanche rescue dog, and work really hard with the local ski areas. We're trying to develop a program that's regional, that we can really combine our efforts and train these dogs to be the best that they can be.
So it seems to me, you know, being, again, the outsider looking in, our area and your role in forecasting avalanches here, in some ways is going to share the similar stresses and uncertainties and vagaries of snow conditions that Little Cottonwood Canyon has, but it's somewhat different too. You're more perhaps recreationally focused, although there's some threat to infrastructure, roads, buildings.
Yeah, you know, I think it's safe to say it's very different, and it's very much the same. The snowpack is the snowpack, and like Liam said, it in his book he talked about how it's a balance of science and art, and I very much agree with that. That, you know, we learn a lot. We go to trainings. We hear what other ski areas are doing, and we apply that. But it's also the experience. It's being out there. It's paying attention. It's knowing what a certain snowpack does. Knowing what a certain slope does. Little Cottonwood Canyon is small compared to the avalanche zones that we're dealing with for the IPAC. You know, we deal with pretty much the whole panhandle and pieces of western Montana. But on the other end of the spectrum, I think Liam says in his book, there's over 300 avalanche paths that are in Little Cottonwood Canyon. They come down from both sides of the mountain. They're steep. They fill with tons of snow. It's an avalanche-prone snowpack. They cross the road. There's people all over the place. I can't even imagine. That's why I asked Liam about the stresses that come along with that, because I can't even imagine some of the situations that he's been in and had to deal with that. So on that spectrum, it is very different. But on the snow spectrum, it's the same. We have avalanche problems here in the Cabinets, the Selkirks, and the Purcells. And, you know, our job is to get out there and try our best to find out where the danger is and let the public know.
Are there any particular pinch points that there's a focused concentration on? I'm thinking, is there any comparable road situation, even remotely so? Is the road to Schweitzer, for instance, likely to ever see an avalanche to the degree that you'd be worried, or someone would be worried about closing it down, or other roads?
You know, I think any road that has a steep road bank and is steep enough to avalanche is under the threat of avalanches. We don't have any roads that historically have, you know, that have avalanched, with the exception of Lookout Pass. You know, a couple of years ago, we did have a snow cycle where we had some avalanches that came off of some road banks kind of up near the pass and actually came into the road and knocked a couple cars to the side. And, you know, so there are some dangers there, and the Department of Transportation is aware of that. And we actually talked to them in those situations. We don't have the problems that, you know, like a Little Cottonwood would have, or some of the other roads in southern Idaho. But our problem is mostly in the backcountry.
Is there a comparable position anywhere in Idaho for what Liam did with the Department of Transportation? Does southern Idaho have a avalanche forecaster for some of the areas around the Sawtooths or other places?
Absolutely. They do have a road forecaster, you know, works for the Department of Transportation. But honestly, I don't think anywhere compares to Little Cottonwood Canyon. It can be a war zone up there. I've seen it with my own eyes. The north side of that highway, those avalanche paths cut right across the road. The southern, the other side of the highway where the ski areas are, those can come down into the parking lots, into the road as well. You know, what's the Rogers Pass, I guess, up north in BC would be the closest that I could think of that would compare to that. But I don't think there's anything in the States that would compare.
Now, at the one end of the spectrum, of course, trying to prevent tragedy from occurring by controlling the avalanches or predicting them and providing good safety information for folks. But things happen, and sometimes there's rescues involved. And Liam talks about some of the rescue dogs in his book, and here locally there's an active rescue dog program. Would you like to provide any updates on that?
Yeah, absolutely. I'll give you a little background there too. When I was at Beaver Creek in Colorado, one of the things that I did there as well was start an avalanche rescue dog program with the help of the other ski patrollers and the resort management. And when we were looking at developing that program, the first place I went was Alta. You know, there's some of the best dog schools in the country are with the Wasatch Backcountry Rescue, and I attended them a couple times. And so I went out there and worked with some of the best dog handlers in the country and really based my philosophy and my thoughts on developing a program on what Alta does. And when I moved up here to North Idaho in Schweitzer, I had a certified avalanche rescue dog. She was 2 at the time. And my job at the forecast center, I wasn't sure if Schweitzer was going to be open to having a dog. And Greg and Arlene, who run our ski patrol, welcomed Annie with open arms. I mean, she's a sweetheart, as anybody who's met her knows, just a great dog. But she was the first dog that, you know, Schweitzer's had a couple dogs through the years, but with developing a comprehensive program, she was really our first dog. And as most of our listeners know, we've added a couple other dogs. We have Abby and Murphy, who are both certified and kind of in the meat of their career. And then we just added, we have a 10-week-old puppy, a little black lab, Maisie, and she is slated to kind of take Annie's place. Annie's 8 years old now, and we were hoping that Annie would have, you know, a couple more years left in her. But unfortunately, Annie had a heart incident, you know, had a heart attack a couple days ago. I'm sad to report. Fortunately, we were, you know, we had some ski patrollers that were right there. We were right there to witness it, and were able to stabilize her and get her to help. And, you know, fortunately, the vet was right here at the bottom of the hill in Pend'Oreille. And we were able to get her the care that she needs. And all the tests that she's taken so far, we're happy with the results. And I can report that she is at home and she's resting and she doesn't know she's hurt. In fact, trying to keep her rested is probably the biggest challenge I have right now. But keep your thoughts and prayers with Annie. She needs them right now. But as far as our program goes, it's been so such an amazing thing to work with. We have such support from the ski area. Silver Mountain has some avalanche rescue dogs, and some of the other areas as well that are in the, I'm trying to think, Tamarack and Brundage and Whitefish, or Big Mountain, as a lot of the locals call it. We're all kind of teaming up together to combine forces and train the best dogs that we can.
Well, our best Annie, beloved by many. Avalanche rescue dog programs deployed not only at Schweitzer, right? They go out and rescues in the backcountry when needed?
Absolutely. Our dogs primarily stay at the top of Schweitzer so that, you know, like you said before, we do everything we can at the ski area to prevent any inbounds avalanches, whether it's explosives or ski cutting or snow, you know, analyzing the snow. That's a huge part of our job. But like we said earlier, Mother Nature has a mind of her own. And when those times happen, having the dogs at the top of the mountain is huge. But we also say that our dogs are there for the community. They're here for as a resource for everybody. And so if we had something happen in the backcountry, we would get there as quick as we can. You know, whether it's a helicopter or a snowmobile or vehicle, we're out there to respond.
We started at the top of the hour with a sort of abbreviated avalanche forecast. But really, to do that justice, there are better resources. Let's turn to those as people are considering their spring skiing this week and going on. What can they do to be safe? How can they best prepare themselves?
You know, I think a good thing to keep in mind right now is that we still are in a pretty deep snowpack with a complex avalanche problem. This time of year, sometimes we're moving into more of an isothermic spring-like snowpack where it's a little more predictable, but we're just not there yet. In fact, it's about as complex as it's been all year. We've had a relatively safe year this year. We haven't had persistent problems that have really run through the whole season like we have in years past. It's been about the safest year I can remember since I've been here. But that can also get our guard down. And so I think it's a good time to keep our guard up and understand that problems lower on the mountain are going to be a little bit different than problems near the top of the mountain on ridges and wind-loaded areas. South faces are going to have sun crust that can provide a good snow surface for avalanches just to slide on. So look at our forecast. We forecast every Tuesday morning, Friday morning, and Saturday morning. Mm-hmm. IdahoPanhandleAvalanche.org.
Very good. And there was one big takeaway from Liam's book. It was that No season's the same. And some of them, despite so-called averages, can start out strong and then whimper out, or can start slow and really build towards late season threats. They're all unique. And I think, Lee, we have time for one more reading, if there's something you'd like to share from the book.
Certainly, I'll continue reading from the prologue. The upper half of the canyon road, approximately 5 miles in length, is a nearly continuous traverse through a variety of moderately large and frequently active avalanche paths. Along this section, there is often very little distance between the track portion of the path, the relatively steep terrain that connects the starting zone and the runout zone, and the road itself. It's far more desirable, if possible, to locate a road further away from the steeper terrain, well into the runout zone, where lower slope angles allow for the moving snow to decelerate and in many cases stop before it can become a problem. When a road travels through steeper terrain near the bottom of the track, relatively small avalanches can pose a threat to traffic. Even if one of these smaller events doesn't score a direct hit on a moving vehicle, it will most likely block traffic in both directions. And then, due to the unusually high volume of traffic on Utah SR 210 during the ski season, within a few minutes, the road will become a narrow, several-mile-long parking lot. We now have a situation where scores of stationary vehicles have become soft targets directly in the sights of numerous adjacent and similarly configured avalanche paths, any one of which may be primed for a release even larger than the initial traffic-blocking event. A lot can happen, snow, weather, and avalanche-wise, between the time the first wave of day skiers arrive and when the last of the stop-and-go traffic exits the canyon some 8 to 10 hours later. The night of my epiphany, February 23rd, was shaping up to be one where all these negative factors just might come together and turn things into a real mess. It was another in a long line of stressful, worrisome, and draining episodes that were starting to wear me down. It hadn't always seemed so hard.
Thank you. What a moving book. Really, again, thoroughly enjoyed reading it. Liam Fitzgerald, author of Throwing Stones in a Glass House, A Career Battling Avalanches in Little Cottonwood Canyon. And, before we close out the hour, any final thoughts from either of you? Liam, we'll let you go first.
I guess I would advise people to make sure they are well prepared for the outing they have planned for the particular day to receive the Idaho Panhandle Avalanche Center forecast. Pay attention to it. Be well equipped when you travel into the backcountry, and train with the equipment that you might have to use to save your best friend or loved one.
Well, thank you, Liam. Jeff, final thoughts?
Yeah, absolutely. Great message, Liam. I guess, you know, I'm going to put a plug in here for the Avalanche Center. As a lot of you know, this is a very organic, growing Avalanche Center, and we have a lot of people that are very passionate about what we do. And, you know, so supporting us any way you can is great. You know, we post our forecasts. We have lots of videos, social media. We do have a membership program that you can find on idahopanhandleavalanche.org. So become a member and you get the forecast emailed to you every time we put it out. But thanks for having us on, Phil, and look forward to seeing you all in the backcountry.
Oh, my pleasure. Liam, before you go, one more time, tell us where folks can find copies of the book.
The book is available at the Corner Bookstore, at Vanderford's, and at Outdoor Experience locally.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Well, if you've just tuned in or want to hear the show again, it'll be available as a podcast. This morning's topic has been avalanche forecasting. We've been joined in the studio here by Liam Fitzgerald, author of Throwing Stones in a Glass House, A Career Battling Avalanches in Little Cottonwood Canyon, and by Jeff Thompson, who's a forecaster with the Idaho Panhandle Avalanche Center. Once again, gentlemen, thank you for joining us this morning.